still, nonetheless, really powerful, really terrific. Performances are outstanding, and it's on terrestrial TV. It's on Sunday night, BBC One. You've got no excuse to not watch it, so please do.
Ooh, terrestrial TV. What's that, Uncle Joey? Is that like Netflix? I love that, terrestrial TV. Hello and welcome to the Danjo Film Show, episode 26. Holy smokes, where did the time go? As always, it's a pleasure to join with you all. Hope you're keeping safe, especially in England, who are gone back into lockdown. Hope you're all keeping safe and inside. And again, a big warm introduction to my partner in crime, the one and only Joe Richards. He truly is my 007. And he can shake and stir me anytime he wants.
Oh, that's a nice one. That's certainly better than my introduction you gave me on the Halloween special.
He's had the hemp. He's had the hemp for the last 2 weeks. He's like, ooh.
Yeah, I have. Like when we met up in the week to go to the cinema, I didn't talk to you for a good long time. You know, you had to wine and dine me, didn't you, Dan, just to make up for that insult.
Absolutely. It was like a bad day. I mean, I thought we were going to start off with fisticuffs, but I bought him a bottle of wine and it was all uphill from there.
I mean, I did come out wearing a bag on my head because I felt that insecure, but you know, it was still nice. It was still a lovely evening. But how are you? I have forgiven you now, by the way, especially after that introduction, but how are you? You okay?
Yeah, I'm very well. It was lovely. We both went out on Monday. We haven't actually seen each other in person or gone out together since like Tenet back in the summer.
Yeah.
And I mean, after that film, we were kind of speechless anyway. So it was lovely to like meet up again on the first day out of lockdown in Wales. And we went to the cinema and we got a cheeky Nando's. And you know, anybody who likes their Nando's, you know, it's got to be extra cheeky when Joe and Dan are in the place. You know what I'm saying? And it was just so much, it was so lovely. It was like, it was genuinely really nice. Because I think we do this show obviously over Zoom and we're not physically in the same room. Mm. And I do think like when we meet up in person, it's just a whole new like connection. And yeah, I loved it. So I'm doing great. Obviously like school is back up and running and the kids are being kids. And what can you do? But yeah, how are you? How's everything with you?
Yeah, good, man. Like we should probably say we're obviously outside of lockdown now. You know, lockdown has ended in Wales. So we weren't being naughty by going to Nando's and going to the cinema. And we weren't breaking any COVID rules. We were very COVID compliant, I think is the word. So it was lovely to see you as well.
Absolutely. And I mean, the only thing that was naughty was the Nando's. I mean, let's be honest.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. I love how many times we're seeing Nando's right now. If you are a member of the Nando's marketing team and you would like to sponsor us, please do get in touch with one of us. That'd be lovely because we do love Nando's.
We do.
Nando's. Anyway, right, moving on. So it was lovely to get out to see you again because like you said, you know, we do record, you know, every fortnight, every week or whatever, and that is lovely to see you on the screen. But it is nice when we're kind of in person and it's a bit more relaxed and we can talk about other things like you know, the presidential election, which took place and we're very, very happy about, you know. So it's lovely to be able to talk about those kinds of things other than just kind of be in work mode, isn't it? It was lovely. We went to see a very different film to Tenet this time. We went to see A Christmas Gift from Bob, which we're going to be talking about a little bit later on, aren't we?
Absolutely. The little ginger fella is back after four grueling years. I've had to succumb to wait for Bob to return. He is back in a Christmassy adventure that will blow your socks off, I tell you what. It was such a good time and we're going to talk about it later. Maybe for not all the reasons that they wanted it to be. But anyway, we laughed and we had fun. So yeah, can't wait to talk about that. And also really, really exciting show today because we've got an exclusive little interview from Steve McQueen's new film. It's called Mangrove. And it's all about racial injustice in the 1970s. It's going to be playing on BBC One on Sunday. So if you have a chance, please go and watch it. But we've got an interview with Sam Sproul, who was just so lovely, wasn't he?
Oh, really, really nice. We'll talk about it a bit more later on.
Definitely.
But, you know, we don't have favourites on the show as as we often say. But he is definitely one of my favourite interviews I think we've done so far to date.
Yeah, absolutely. He was more than a favourite than Nando's. There we are. Finish it off there. And also, not just Mangrove we're talking about today, we're also going to be reviewing a lot of different kind of movies today. I got a chance to go watch Words on a Bathroom Walls, which is the new film with Charlie Plummer in. Also, we'll be chatting about SpongeBob, SquarePants, Sponge on the Run, which is on Netflix at the minute for all the kiddies out there, if you want to watch that. And don't forget, obviously, we've got our lovely review of Christmas Gift with Bob to look forward to. So make sure to stay tuned to today's show. It's going to be a real good one.
Captain. Neuf à la banque.
I need carte. Another 1,000.
I admire your courage, Miss...
Trench. Sylvia Trench. I admire your luck, Mr...
Bond. James Bond.
Mr. Bond, I suppose you wouldn't care to, raise the limit?
I have no objections.
C'est pas possible, madame. C'est illégal,
monsieur. Now.
C'est suivi, monsieur.
First, let's get to the main news story of today. And obviously, starting on a bit of a somber note this week, the first 007, James Bond, Sean Connery, sadly passed away at the age of 90. The Scottish actor was best known for his portrayal of James Bond, being the first to bring the role to the big screen and appearing in 7 of the spy thrillers. Sean obviously died peacefully in his sleep in the Bahamas. I mean, what a way to go. I mean, God, a gorgeous Bahamas. But yeah, Joe, how did you respond to this? Because the news broke, I think, on Saturday, I believe. And obviously, during that time, there's a lot about lockdown. I did feel bad because I did feel like this story was just kind of, you know, kept under the radar. But for me, I think the best Bond, I mean, surely a classic Bond.
Yeah, I definitely think whether or not he's the best, he's definitely classic. I think for me, with my Bonds, it's between him and Daniel Craig, because I was in my first year of university when Casino Royale came out, the reboot with Daniel Craig. And I'd watched all the Bonds previously, especially, you know, I've got a fond affection of James Bond. Me and my older brother, we always go watch them together when we can. Our grandfather used to take us to see a couple of them. You know, my last kind of cinematic memory of my grandfather is watching The World Is Not Enough, which gets far too much grief than it deserves. Yes. I mean, I love The World Is Not Enough.
Amen. Brilliant. Amen.
Between Bond, when I was in university and Daniel Craig came out and Casino Royale came out, it was so fresh and it'd been a while since we'd seen Bond, and I thought, I love this. And I think everybody expected Daniel Craig to be awful, and he was great. And I think he is up there for me, but it is definitely between him and Connery. I think Connery, as you said, is the classic Bond. He kind of set the precedent for all Bonds sort of going forward, really. He kind of, you start off at this really high level and, you know, every other actor then kind of had to kind of try and match that. And I think that's why, you know, the Bond after him was George Lazenby, and he did one film, and I think people are like, oh, you know, he's no Sean Connery. And then obviously we had Roger Moore, and there was a very different type of Bond to Connery's in the first place. But I think when you look back at Ian Fleming's books especially, and his vision of who James Bond was, I think Sean Connery perfectly encapsulates that. And I think that's why he's very much the kind of archetypal Bond and a lot of people's favourites. And he's got some of the best films. He's got Goldfinger. He's got From Russia With Love. Dr. No. He's got some of the best Bond movies out there. So, you know, it was very sad to hear of. And just outside of Bond as well, obviously you've got, you know, a lot of other fantastic performances. I love it. I mean, I grew up like in the 90s when I was younger. He had a string of, you know, hits, which I just loved outside of Bond. You know, I love, like, it didn't get mentioned at all, but like Entrapment with Catherine Zeta-Jones, have you ever seen that? Good. And The Rock, one of the only Michael Bay films I kind of like, to be honest.
With our boy Nick Cage.
And you got Nick Cage and Sean Connery, and they, you know, fighting bad guys on Alcatraz. It's an absolutely brilliant movie, and it is one of the only Michael Bay movies I can stand. And then obviously you've got films like Highlander, which are iconic. Obviously, The Untouchables as well, which he won an Oscar for. Just absolutely brilliant. You know, he could literally do it all. He could do the action, he could do the drama, and he had great comic timing as well. And that's, you know, never been more present than in The Last Crusade, Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, which, you know, I'm a big fan of. I love Indy. I've got my poster in the background of Raiders.
No, I didn't notice that. I really didn't notice that at all.
He's got such perfect comic timing in that film. You know, there's so many great moments in that movie, which are just genius. Like classic, they feel like classic comic performances, like the Three Stooges or something like that. And, you know, he's got some great moments. Like I think my favorite moment is when they're in the plane. And, you know, he's got to take control of the gun, and he's like shooting a Nazi fighter, and he kind of turns all the way around and he ends up shooting their own plane. And Indy's like, what's happened? And he's like, sorry, son, we've been hit. They got us. And like, they got us. And I just think it's just perfect comic timing. He was truly one of the greats. And I think that's why, when it broke, and it broke on Halloween as well, so that sort of kind of, you know, wasn't the best time. You know, people are sad because, you know, it's been a while since he's done anything, but his persona, his you know, kind of performances will live long past him. So a really sad day, really sad news. But what did you think about Connery? I mean, you're a fan of his Bond performance, I guess?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think each Bond kind of brings their own unique spin and qualities to the role, doesn't it? And I think all the Bonds have been exceptional. I really struggle to kind of say, well, he's definitely the worst Bond and he's the best. But I think Sean Connery was the first, wasn't he? And he was a classic Bond. He had this kind of suave, charming, sophisticated nature to Bond. And he definitely had the looks as well. He's very, very handsome, you know, back in the day. And again, I feel like all the Bonds after him kind of had different qualities, but didn't quite capture kind of the handsome nature that Bond is and how kind of charming he is to the women and you know, all the Bond girls. For me, yeah, I think Roger Moore for me is always, I just grew up with him. Well, I guess not grew up with him, but he was just a person that has done the most Bond films, so I just gravitated towards him. The Man with the Golden Gun is still my favourite Bond film of all time. But yeah, Sean Connery, close second for me, definitely, because like I said, in terms of his films, Dr. No obviously is the first, but for me, his films like Diamonds Are Forever, I always remember the scene with the scorpion in the desert and how scary that was. But you're right, he kind of left, George Lazenby took over, and then he came back. And I think The reason he came back is because he has, you know, such a love and affinity for the series. And then he also did that spin-off Bond film. I don't know whether anyone can remember that.
Never Say Never Again.
I love it because it's so, like, you know, it's so ironic, isn't it? Because he did say it again. you know, but he will be, you know, surely missed. You know, he'll go down as an absolute, you know, iconic actor, not just for Bond, like you said, The Last Crusade, films like The Untouchables. And yeah, I mean, the industry has lost a true great, definitely.
Dad! He's coming back.
I suddenly remembered my Charlemagne. Let my armies be the rocks and the trees and the birds in the sky.
Shall we move on to now some reviews? And we're going to start with a film that I saw this week. Joanne didn't get a chance to watch this, but it is getting quite a limited release in cinemas at the minute. And this is called Words on Bathroom Walls. It's directed by Thor Rudenthal. And it stars Charlie Plummer, who we love, who we haven't seen for a long, long time. And he plays a young teenager who gets diagnosed with schizophrenia. And his ambition in life is to become a chef. He loves cooking. He finds that when he cooks, all the voices in his head, all these kind of people that he sees through his schizophrenia and through his disorder, they all seem to go away when he cooks. However, when an incident happens at his school, he is expelled. He has to attend a Catholic private school in which his parents have to basically fund him through. And he meets up with one of the girls at the school, Taylor Russell, who you may know from Waves this year, excellent actress. Basically, they kind of develop this relationship, this bond, but he still feel like he can't fully open up about his disorder. And then, of course, he starts an experimental drug, which, you know, causes his own issues. And the film kind of looks at how his life spirals out of control and how he feels like he can never really truly be himself. Here's a clip.
Why don't you tell me about the restaurant you're taking me to?
Well, basically, it's my dream kitchen. I've studied the menu for years, and nobody invents like they do. It's the kind of place I'd like to work at one day, maybe even own. We'll see.
Oh, right, when Cheese Camp finally pays off?
Hey, you laugh, but Cheese Camp was a spiritual experience. And the kitchen is just my place. When I'm cooking, it's like everything disappears. And I get to be exactly who I want to be. I'm in control.
I respect that. You have to choose exactly who you want to be. Life's too short.
So, like I said, I heard absolutely nothing about this. I went with my other half last night, and she really, really wants to watch it because she's currently doing like a diploma, a criminology diploma. And she was like, oh, this is educational about schizophrenia. And, you know, it is a teen drama. It is a teen coming of age story. And whenever you hear that, you think, oh, no, it's, you know, it's going to be the stereotypical teen, you know, high school drama that we've seen time and time again. But this couldn't be further from it. And I think going in blind just helped a lot. Also, I was very emotionally susceptible yesterday, so I feel like the film worked in that respect. But I just think, you know, with this type of story, it is really difficult to nail a concept like schizophrenia, which firstly, nobody really knows about. And secondly, when we have seen it in films, it's either been done so poorly and so exaggerated, and you could just watch it and go, well, they haven't done their research. But what I loved about this film is, you know, the film has done its research into schizophrenia. It was really interesting how he has these hallucinations, how he sees all these kind of three characters that keep popping into his head all the time, that are speaking to him, that are telling him to do certain things. And also just kind of how, you know, all the pills that he's taken and how he's tried every single experimental drug you can think of. And all it's done is basically, you know, given him muscle pain. It's given him diarrhea. It's given him, you know, tiredness. It's made him have suicidal thoughts. And I think the film works really well in the sense that you sympathize with him from the get-go. And you really just feel confined. You feel really lost and isolated, just like he is. You know, you really do, you are transported into his head and what he's going through. And that helps as well, because what I love in the film is there's a lot of breaking the fourth wall. And throughout the film, you as an audience member are the psychiatrist and he's speaking to you. He's saying, well, you told me to do this, you told me to do that. I love that. I thought it was so, so clever. And it's not used enough in films today. So that is another reason how they get the audience to kind of get inside this boy's head, and that's how you just really invest in him and you really want to get through this. Even when he spirals out of control, even when you can see the future's bleak for this character, you're rooting for him the entire time. You really want just to have a normal life. And also because I feel like people don't really understand schizophrenia. They jump to conclusions all the time. And the film addresses that really, really well. How, you know, he starts the school and he doesn't really want to tell anybody he's got this mental illness because everyone will judge him. Everyone will just want to dissociate themselves with him. The father in the film, or the stepfather, I should say, played by Walton Goggins, he's great because he just takes all the knives out of the house and he's just like, well, you know, I don't want to be too, you know, too careless. And I thought the film was just beautiful. You know, it's really, really kind of a great script. Beautiful performances, especially from Charlie Plummer. I said in my review, he's a tour de force, and I don't use that film often, but oh my gosh, like he is just incredible in this. And the relationship he has with Taylor Russell, I really bought. And I think what I love the most about this film is that teens dramas and coming of age dramas can fall down this really obvious problem of, you know, stereotypes, stereotypical characters and archetypes, and you've seen it all before. And the movie does reach those points and I go, oh, here we go, this is what's going to happen, and automatically it corrects itself straight away. And I'm just like, wow, that's so refreshing that the film is doing that and not falling into those gaps like other teen dramas have had before. So I thought it was such a poignant, touching story, and so refreshing to have a film about schizophrenia and actually execute it well and actually tell the truth about the illness and not just sugarcoat it or completely get it wrong. So I love this. I thought it was absolutely terrific. I adored it. It's in my top five of the year, not quite my favorite film of the year. But Taylor Russell, I mean, she's in both my number one film of the year and this. So whatever she's doing, whatever she's eating, I want it. Okay. Whatever you're doing, girl, keep doing it. So yeah, I loved it. And I employ anyone, whether you're interested in mental illness or a teen drama, I think this just ticks all the boxes. It is such a shame that it is just not going to reach anybody, because obviously, you know, England's in lockdown. Wales have limited cinemas open at the minute. And this film, they just released it without a care. So hopefully it can go into streaming. Hopefully it can reach a bigger audience, because I think this is a diamond in the rough. And I think, you know, so many more people deserve to see it.
Wow. Well, I was very shocked yesterday when I received your rating through quite late. 5 stars. I was like, wow, I was not expecting that at all. It has been a while. And that makes me excited now for the end of year show 2020 film review, because, you know, it's anybody's game. I thought we were at a point where there were going to be no surprises, but it goes to show it's anybody's game right now. And, you know, something could come along and just pip, you know, something else to the post.
Well, who knows? Christmas Gift with Bob might just get up there. Who knows? Yeah, it was great. I really missed, you know, giving a 5-star to a film. I hope a lot of people watch it, because I think it is an important film. And yeah, so definitely go and check it out. Words in the Bathroom Walls. It's currently in cinemas now, limited release. Hopefully you'll be able to watch it at home soon.
I love my life. I love you so much, Gary. I'll never forget the day we met.
Ready!
Hello, little snail. What's your name? Gary, huh? Do you want to be friends?
Me too.
Gary, I'm home. Gary? Gare Bear? Gary? Gary! Have you seen Gary?
No.
Nope.
Nope.
Gary's been snail mapped.
This summer, the search begins.
Friends don't let friends go on dangerous quests alone! Yeah!
With all new faces.
Hello. Call me Sage.
Good name.
I'm made out of sage and I am a sage. So it works out pretty well.
I'm Patrick. My name means toaster in Celtic.
Pretty sure it doesn't.
Should we move on now to something very, very different? This is SpongeBob SquarePants, Sponge on the Run. No mental illness in this one. This is a kids' film, obviously following on from the very popular Nickelodeon show. Did you ever watch the show, Joe, or were you kind of out of it?
No, I was too old for that, Dan, as I'm sure you would relish. Because, you know, you were probably in nappies when it came out or something like that. I don't know. But I bet you love that. I knew you were going to ask that question. It was a bit after my time. I know the theme tune, you know, that theme tune, you know, you ready, kids? I know all that business.
Oh, yeah.
I know he's a sponge and he lives under the sea, under a pineapple or something like that, in a pineapple.
Yeah, yeah. You're doing really well.
So, yeah, I've not seen the show, but what I will say is I'd seen one of the other films which came out a couple of years ago, well, a few years ago now. I think it was called Sponge Out of Water. And they put the SpongeBob characters, similar to the kind of what they do here, they put them into a kind of live action environment. And I thought it was all right. I thought it was pretty decent and I had a good time with it. And I thought it was weird, but my kind of weird, you know? So I really had a lot of fun with it. This film, I can't say I had much fun with at all, to be perfectly honest. The story this time around is kind of revolves around SpongeBob and his lovely, cute companion, Gary the Snail. It makes perfect sense when we live in a day and age where Baby Yoda is all over the place, you know, merchandise everywhere. Though they were trying to make it cutesy, and this is very cutesy. It kind of delves into where SpongeBob kind of met Gary in the first place, and there's a lot of scenes I mean a lot of scenes which are flashbacks to how SpongeBob met various characters in, you know, at Sponge Camp or whatever it is, summer camp, I don't know. And basically, Gary is snail-napped. He's taken away. He's snail-napped because basically these snails under the sea, the fluid, what's the term I should use here, the gunge?
No, yeah, I think fluid covers it,
yeah,
really well.
The, yeah, fluid.
Yeah, can you say that a couple more times, please, Joe?
Yeah, the fluid that the snails have, you know, they apparently they give revitalizing goodness to skin and things like that. So King Poseidon, voiced, I've got to say, tremendously by Matt Berry, has run out of snails. He needs a new one. And yeah, Gary is taken. And SpongeBob and Patrick go on an adventure to try and find him. As I say, I'm not a big fan of it. You know, I've not seen the original series. I haven't got a big affection of it. I didn't grow up with it. I think if you have got that affection for the film, for the show, you'll probably love this. I thought this was fine to a point. I sat there and for about the first 45 minutes, I thought, this is okay. It's making me chuckle a little bit. There's a great sequence probably about half an hour in, which involves Snoop Dogg, Danny Trejo, and Keanu Reeves. And that's like the holy trinity of cinema we never knew we needed, you know? Yeah. Like those three in the same scene together is cinematic perfection. And that was quite funny and made me chuckle quite a bit. The main problem I have with the film is that in the final act, it just becomes too talky. It just loses its way for me. For what felt like an eternity, for about 10, 15 minutes in the final act, they seem to be stood on a stage. It never seems to change scene, really. They stood on a stage and Patrick goes, SpongeBob goes, oh, well, this is how I met Patrick. And then they'll do a flashback and they say how SpongeBob meets Patrick. And then Patrick will walk off. And then the squirrel astronaut person, whatever, goes, oh, this is how I met SpongeBob. And then they'll do the flashback. And then there was a lot of back and forth in the final act, which just really kind of, for a film which was so high energy, it just seemed to just lull, like really quickly. Just the energy just seemed to drop all of a sudden. And that really annoyed me. I thought I was really struggled to get through that final half an hour. So I think if you're a fan of the series, I think you'll probably love it. You'll be like, this is classic SpongeBob. Oh, classic SpongeBob, you know, doing this. And like, it's some, you know, there are some funny elements in there. I think Keanu Reeves is perfect that moment, but they overuse that gag as well. He just keeps popping up. And I just thought it was all right up to a point, and then it just really let me down in the final act. But I'm sure, considering, you know, you were like 3 years old when SpongeBob came out and probably grew up with it, you probably had all the merchandise. I'm sure you're going to tell me that you loved it, right?
Who lives in a punt? No, I'm not doing that. No, actually, you know what? I've never liked the series. I was never a Nickelodeon boy. I was a Disney Channel boy back in the day. You know, give me Disney any day. Nickelodeon wasn't my thing. But what's weird about SpongeBob is I feel like the age range of it is just so mysterious. Is it like, is it for younger kids? And I know a lot of teenagers find it really, really funny as well. And even people my age now are like, oh, SpongeBob's, you know, has some funny lines. I wasn't a fan of the TV series. I felt like it went on way, way too long. And I've not seen the other two films. I feel like they keep making these films and I'm like, we'll just keep doing the TV series. It's like if the Simpsons movie did Simpsons movie 2 and 3, it doesn't make any sense. So I'm not a huge fan of the first SpongeBob. And I got it. The first 20 minutes of this film, I was not enjoying it all. I thought, wow, this is basically watching the TV series. It's very televisual. Every time there's a scene change, you see the bubbles. And then you have 15 minutes later. And I just thought, wow, I might as well just be watching a TV episode right now. But I agree. I think when they come up to the surface, when they've got to go on this wild adventure to retrieve Gary, and when they've got to go into a saloon where they're greeted by Snoop Dogg and Danny Trejo, I thought, wow, this is absolutely bonkers. Like, this is going the complete opposite way from the first 20 minutes. It's like they switched directors in the half an hour mark, and he was like, right, move over. I just thought it took so many chances and risks, and it jeopardized its core fan base of young kids, because there's no way young kids are going to be like, oh, there's Snoop Dogg, there's Danny Trejo, oh, there's dancing zombies. I'm like, it makes no sense. But I love the fact that it doesn't follow the stereotypical conventional kids route. So the film I thought about a lot was Scoob back a couple of months ago, and how dull that was, and how it was just like, oh, followed the same beats as the series and didn't do anything risky, didn't have any risky jokes. And I thought this film at least tried and was trying to be ambitious and was trying to appeal to adults as well. And I thought it worked on that level. And I thought when they went to the surface, I found lots of bits really, really funny. Again, there's the ongoing joke about Kenny G, about this kind of clarinet player who Squidward is just loves. And he's like, oh, Kenny G's going? It just makes no sense. This film makes absolutely no sense. But I just had a lot of fun with it and I enjoyed it. And I think, you know, I love the animation. I love that it's more of a 3D animation compared to the series. I thought the character design was really well done. The voiceovers are the same as the series, so they kept that going. And again, I just found myself chuckling every 10 minutes or so. And I thought, well, for a kid's film, you know, for a kid's film that I'm not really, if I chuckle once or twice, I'd be lucky. For a kid's film, I'm really enjoying this. And again, it's on Netflix. I'm glad they didn't put this into cinemas. And from what I've seen, it's not doing great on Netflix. It's still like at number 3, number 4, and it hasn't really quite reached number 1, which I was surprised by. And in America, they've got to wait till February. So I don't know about that. I enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun with it. I think fans of the series are going to really enjoy it. For me, the sections where they go above the surface, where they go and they're greeted by Keanu Reeves as a sage, those sections for me, I just found bizarre and bonkers. And I relished in it. I was just like, yeah, okay, we're going to do this. I'm happy. You're right. There are a lot of flashbacks. There are a lot of, you know, the story isn't great. The continuity isn't great. But I wasn't bothered by that. It's a short film. It's 80 minutes and it flew by for me. And I don't know. I really enjoyed it. And 2 tickets for Kenny G, please. Thank you. Well, there we are. There we are. So SpongeBob Sponge on the Run is currently on Netflix here in the UK. So go check it out, kids.
On Sunday, the 9th of August in North Kensington, a demonstration took place against the police, which degenerated into totally inexcusable violence. There may be some who believe that they have been the victim of injustice at the hands of the police. Others who, like parasites, feed on these beliefs and seek to turn them to their own advantage, deliberately creating hate and violence. These defendants are all guilty of the serious criminal offence.
This attack on a black establishment is not an isolated event, but a sustained campaign against black people. And today we are saying enough is enough.
We're now joined by actor Sam Spruill. He stars in Steve McQueen's brand new film, Mangrove. You can catch it November 15th on BBC One. You may know him also from films like Legend, Snow White and the Huntsman, and Taken 3, of course. Please welcome to the show, Sam Spruill. Thank you for joining us, Sam.
Oh, pleasure, lads. Nice to be here.
And thank you. And firstly, how are you? How's lockdown been for you? Obviously, a very strange year for actors and everyone in the industry. But how have you been coping this year?
Well, aside from the usual kind of existential worries and worrying about the pandemic and the country and family and friends, actually, when it hit, it was, I think there's universal appreciation on the part of actors just to stop and not be involved in the kind of usual hustle of our trade and or kind of to be free of the neurosis of other actors doing this or doing that and you not involved. Or, you know, it was actually, yeah, just to know phone calls from agents or hassling your agents for work, or it was just really nice to stop. And yeah, that calm was great. It's now September and I'm very pleased to be back at work.
Yeah, absolutely. I can imagine. And you're here today to talk to us.
October.
Actually, yeah.
I was going to say, but I was like, you know what? Don't worry, it's fine.
Yeah, actually, that is COVID for you. Like, nobody knows where we are currently at the moment.
Is it Christmas yet?
We're seeing pumpkins in the aisles for September, and we're very confused. But yeah, so it's understandable. But yeah, you're here today to talk to us about your role as PC Frank Pulley in Steve McQueen's Mangrove, which we saw a couple of weeks back. Can you tell us a little bit about how you became involved in the project and how much you knew of the actual true life story before joining the film?
I really just became involved because the casting director, Gary Davey, he's cast me in a few things. He just got me along to meet Steve McQueen and read for this part. And actually, I read it completely differently to how I performed it. And that was partly to do with the script, partly because of my understanding of who this guy was. But thankfully, there were rehearsals before filming started, and I understood more about who this guy was, and I think brought in a performance that Steve preferred, because he kept on saying, God, you were so different in that audition to how you are now. So it was really through the casting director, thank goodness for him. And then with regards to how much I knew about the story, very little, you know. And I think working on this project has been really good for kind of just an education in of kind of Black history with regards to London, you know, and for that, you know, really grateful. And just to really kind of also assess the impact of Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech and what was going on in the country at that time. Yeah, really informative.
Was there any hesitation taken on the role? Because you've played villains before, but nowhere near as nasty as this one. And also obviously based on a real life character. Was there any hesitation taken on the role? Did you think it's a challenge, I'm going to, you know, jump into it?
Yeah, I've played a lot of meanies, and there is always a slight hesitation because you go, oh, God, I've got to go to that kind of dark place again. And while I think with all these characters, there is intrinsic humanity involved as well. It's not kind of just like evil and that's it. There's damage, there's kind of jealousy, there's a kind of rich emotional makeup in playing a character like this, but you do have to go to dark places. And that's, so I do kind of pause before accepting stuff like this, but it's the chance to work with Steve McQueen. And those are the kind of directors I want to work with. He's one of Britain's great exports, isn't he? You know, he's on the worldwide scene, but he really, I think for this project, it's a kind of much smaller, much grittier project than his last one. And the chance to work with him on something like this was too good not to. And then, of course, it's a kind of a Black historical story, and I was playing number one racist in it. And so that's quite a tough place to occupy on set and in your head, you know. But that's why they pay me the small bucks. Anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you've touched upon it there, but maybe you could elaborate a bit more. So, because obviously when you're playing villains, how do you approach that? Because as you said there yourself, you know, I suppose as an actor, you're looking for that three-dimensionality, you're looking for that depth, even though you're playing a villain, you know, you're looking for that connection, I suppose, and that understanding of why that person is the way they are. So yeah. How did you kind of approach that with PC Frank Pulley?
I thought about, yeah, I don't think about him being evil. I think about, and I don't necessarily think about kind of him being aware of his kind of inherent racism. I think about what's happened to him in his life that makes him unable to feel generous towards this section of the community. You know, so a kind of lack of success in his own life. You know, with all villains, it's about, for me, accessing the emotional damage that they've suffered and then going from there. You have to have had suffered that kind of damage to want to inflict it on someone else.
And obviously Mangrove is dealing with very sensitive subject matter, and it's a very relevant film, especially for this year. It couldn't be more relevant. What was the atmosphere like on set with the cast and crew? Was it the sense of you're doing something really important here, or was it a sense of, you know, we're coming together, we're doing this, you know, really, really kind of excellent film to showcase this really kind of sensitive subject matter?
I think there was a number of things at play. A really important story, a black historical story set in London. There hasn't been many of those. I think also working for Steve McQueen makes the project very important, because he's chosen to spend time on this project. So you know it's important. He just doesn't do unimportant work. And the atmosphere was very focused. And again, that's led by Steve. But also, I guess for my part, I kept myself quite separate. And I think the actors playing the Mangrove Nine also kept themselves quite separate as well, because we were having to, despite kind of being nice on set or whatever, you're kind of half staying in character. And you never want to lose that on a project that's so important. And so you can't really break out of the characters you've set up for yourself. And so, yeah, there is a kind of distance, and I did feel quite isolated on set, but that was my choice to isolate myself, you know.
Brilliant. We've actually got a question here now. What we did, we put it on Instagram, we put it on Twitter that we were interviewing you, Sam, and we had a response from Sophia Pilsova on Instagram, who's asked a question. She asked many questions. One of them was, are you married? The question I think we were going to ask you of those questions.
Well, I am married, so yeah.
Sophia, I'm really sorry.
She also asked, what would you say has been the most difficult and challenging role in your career to date?
Most difficult role I've done, actually, I think, was I played Cavendish in The North Water with Andrew Haig directing. Which is this BBC Two drama set on an 1850 whaling ship that goes up to the Arctic. And I think the thing about that character was he went on such a journey, and I think he really travelled as a character. And so you have to kind of plot that journey from happy-go-lucky kind of opportunist to someone who really is out of their depth and feeling very afraid. And I think that was, over the months, such a kind of rich but tricky journey to negotiate. And I think when I finished it, I felt really exhausted and I had a little cry. So I don't think I've ever done that with a part. So yeah, I think that's the one. And maybe in the theatre, Iago. I played Iago, and that was unbelievably difficult for me personally, but hugely rewarding. Yeah,
brilliant. And finally, you're a very, very busy man. Have you got any future projects coming up you can tell us about?
Yes, I suppose I can. I'm like looking for Romilly. I don't know whether I could say. No, I'm. I yeah. No. I, can I say it?
No.
No.
Okay. Oh,
sorry.
No, yeah.
Sorry.
No, I mean, no. But no, I did a film with Isilde de Besco, a French director, in the summer called Connemara, which was really interesting. And then also, yeah, The North Water, which is coming out. And I just worked with Doug Liman on a film called Lockdown with Chiwetel Ejiofor. Working with Doug Liman was interesting. And he's obviously kind of done a gazillion films, and that film Lockdown will be hopefully very funny. It's written by Nick Knight as well, so yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Sam, for taking the time. We really, really appreciate it. It's been brilliant to talk to you. And everyone, please go watch Steve McQueen's Mangrove. It's coming to BBC One November 15th. So nobody's got an excuse now. It's not in cinemas. You can stay at home and watch it. And it is such an important film for this year. So, Sam, thank you so much again.
Oh, thanks, lads. Lovely to meet you, lads.
And that was our interview there with Sam Sprewell. Such a lovely guy. I know we don't have favourite interviews, Joe, but he's definitely up there for me. He was so, so lovely and charming. And again, gave us a good insight into what it's like playing a villain because he's played so many villains. I mean, I feel like, you know, maybe he is a villain in real life, but from the sounds of it, he sounds lovely. So...
yeah, he was absolutely lovely, so down to earth, and yeah, just like I said, one of my favorite interviews. I've always had, like I said, an interview, I've always had that sort of like fascination about actors playing villains and how you approach that and how you connect to that character. If you're playing like a really nasty, horrible person, you know, acting in these intense sequences, how do you approach that? And, you know, because I agree with what Sam was saying in the interview. All these people, I'm a firm believer in life, you know, there's always two sides to the story. You know, it doesn't excuse people's behaviors, but there is usually a reason why a person is the way that they are. So I think it was fascinating to hear how he approaches those types of roles. And it's nice to hear from like the actor's perspective as well, because we've had a lot of filmmakers, we've had a lot of, you know, we've had like David Creed and, you know, David Frayne, Derek Board, a lot of filmmakers join us on the show. But it's nice to see, you know, the kind of process from in front of the camera for a change. But Mangrove itself, as you said, Dan, it is as well, which is really exciting. It is on BBC One on Sunday night. So this isn't a case where people have to go to the cinema. I know there are a lot of people who are still feeling nervous about going to the cinema. Obviously, if you're based in England, you can't go to the cinema. This is a case that will be on television, 9 o'clock Sunday night on BBC One. It's there for anybody to watch. It'll be on iPlayer afterwards. And this is the first installment in a series of films from Steve McQueen. It's known as the Small Axe series. I think it's going to go to Amazon Prime as well, shortly after airing on BBC One. This premiered at the London Film Festival, and it got a lot of buzz there as well. And it tells the story of the Mangrove Nine. It's a true story, who clashed with London police in 1970, and about the trial that kind of came as a result of that. And it was the sort of first judicial acknowledgement of racial hatred within the Metropolitan Police. When I saw this a couple of weeks ago, we obviously had a screener for it. I watched it, and for me, it's a film of two halves. The first half of the film felt a bit slow. I'm not going to lie, I struggled to get into it for whatever reason. I mean, it's got that usual sense of just visual vibrancy that you kind of expect from Steve McQueen. You know, he really captures 1970s London, and there's a lot of sequences, you know, set within the mangrove and everything like that, which are great. They're perfectly executed. You feel like you're there. You can feel the smoke. You can just feel the atmosphere of the whole thing. But that said, I was struggling to connect to it within the first hour. Now, I'm not sure if this is because literally a couple of days previously, I'd seen Aaron Sorkin's The Trial of the Chicago 7, which is similar in a lot of respects. It deals with, you know, the freedom of speech. It deals with the power of protest. In certain ways, it's got, you know, a similar format. You know, you kind of got the trial going on and flashback into what the events that led to the trial. This doesn't have that same sort of energy as The Trial of Chicago 7. It doesn't flash back and forwards. The first half, it literally kind of is a slow burner, building up to the central protest in the heart of the film, which as a result, you get the final kind of hour, which is all about the trial. And it is a longish film. It's about 2 hours 20. So there's a lot in there to kind of digest as well. About the midway point was where I really started, the kind of wheels started to turn for me. I really started to invest in the film. In the second half of the film, you really get a lot of the interaction between the various characters in the Mangrove Nine, and the performances across the board are just outstanding. You've got Sean Parks, who plays sort of the lead, I guess, Frank Critchlow, and Letitia Wright as well, who plays Althea Jones. And she's kind of in the posters, a really powerful image with a fist in the air. And you've got you just an outstanding cast, and seeing all the various members of the Mangrove Nine interact more in the second half, it just drove the energy up for me. And I just started to feel feel that connection to the characters and to the story. And it is a very powerful story. And the courtroom sequences are just intense. Like, there's moments which are so, like, uncomfortable to watch. And I'll just say briefly as well, with Sam Spruill as PC Pully, he's just absolutely tremendous. Like, the first half of the film, he's more present in, and he is, the second you see him on screen, you are terrified. Like, you know he's a bad guy and he's going to do bad things. And he's just absolutely fantastic. But my favorite moment in the film of his is probably in the court case, where he's, like, he's being interrogated by, you know, he's being cross-examined by the Mangrove Nine, and they basically go all out to just humiliate him in front of the court, and it's just so uncomfortable. It's, like, fantastic to watch, because you're like, this guy is not a nice person. It's great to see him sort of get his comeuppance and sweat a little bit, but at the same time, it's just so uncomfortable to watch. And Sam Spruill's performance in that moment is terrific, because it's all about the little kind of gestures that the camera focuses on to, you know, kind of see how he's feeling inside, and that anger and that embarrassment kind of building. So, you know, it took me a while to get into, but when I was into it, I was fully invested. And I think the main takeaway that I have from it, and I think it's why this is particularly important, obviously you mentioned in the interview, you know, this year it kind of been more relevant with the Black Lives Matters movement going on and everything like that across the world. But I think what Sam mentioned in his interview, and I think the biggest kind of draw to this for me, is the fact that it is a story of racism in Britain. It's a story of racism in London. And we don't see those movies much. You know, it's, how many movies do we see set in America, you know, where, you know, I probably can count 8-10 films over the last 12 months which have been released, you know, talking about racial injustices in the States. And that's fine, and that's important. You know, I love Queen and Slim. It's one of my favorite films of the year. But we never see these sorts of films being made about the UK. And I think there, especially when Black Lives Matter movement happened and everything, you know, kind of kicked off with George Floyd back, you know, a few months ago, there's still a lot of people who think these problems exist solely within America, solely without, you know, outside of the British borders. And that's not the case at all. So I think this film is so much more important, because it shines a light on a story like Sam, which I wasn't aware of, and I think a lot of people won't be aware of it. And it shines a light on such an important story, and it kind of makes people think and realize that, yeah, this happens. Even though it's set in the 1970s, it still happens today. And it's not just a USA problem. It is a worldwide problem. So it is important. It is vital. It's probably one of the most important films of the year. It is a film of two halves. Be patient with it. Kind of take your time with it. It is a slow burner. And I think it is all the more rewarding then in that final hour, for kind of, you know, sticking with it. So it's not Steve McQueen's best. It's not my favorite of his, but it is still nonetheless really powerful, really terrific. Performances are outstanding, and it's on terrestrial TV. It's on Sunday night, BBC One. You've got no excuse to not watch it. So please do.
Ooh, terrestrial TV. What's that, Uncle Joey? Is that like Netflix? I love that, terrestrial TV.
Well, but come on, everybody,
get your wires
digital?
Going.
Digital? I don't know. I don't know what it is.
That is such a good term, Joe. Well done.
Yeah,
such
but a good term. Anyway, watch it. Please watch it.
Definitely. I totally agree. And it's on BBC One on this Sunday. So check it out.
Who'd like to hear some Christmas carols, Bob style?
Last Christmas, me and Bob worked on the streets.
Happy Christmas.
I thought you could use some Christmas cheer.
There's a lot of things I could use right now. Getting my gas and hot water back on.
That cat does not look happy to me.
Can you control your dog?
We wanted to chat to you about a couple of concerns.
You can't take him away from me.
It's in the cat's best interest.
If a guy who works on the street is being separated from his cat at Christmas, it's got to be done by the book.
You got to help me. Threatening to take Bob away.
I
back, they should.
Anyone who knows the man and the cat, get in touch.
You have proved your love 100 times over.
It's not normal for a cat to be out in the streets.
James gives Bob the choice to stay at home or go out with him. And every day, Bob goes with him.
I dreamt of snow back when I was
a... Why is it always about you, James?
What's happened?
Break in. They took everything. I'm
on my way. The angels are all around us if we just know where to look.
Merry Christmas, my love. Merry Christmas.
Christmas isn't a season. It's a feeling. Whatever form your family takes, that's what Christmas is about.
And finally, our last film we're going to talk about, we've saved a real Christmas treat for last. This is the long-awaited sequel to A Street Cat Named Bob. It's called A Christmas Gift from Bob. And again, it's directed by Charles Martin Smith. It stars Luke Treadaway, and he plays a struggling street musician who finds himself the target of an animal welfare investigation that threatens to take away his beloved cat, Bob, at Christmas time. And now Joe and I were really excited to watch this because we're both such big fans of the first film. I mean, for me, it was my number three film of the year. And all mainly because of Bob and just how adorable he is. And again, I just want to say, rest in peace, Bob. You'll be surely missed. And yes. And again, following a similar story to last time, at the end of the last film, we had Luke Treadaway's character. He plays James. He ends up writing the book that gets him famous. This time around, it follows like a Christmas Carol setup where he looks back to the past and you know how he was able to get off the streets, get his own place, and how he was able to take care of Bob. And I don't know about you, I much preferred the first film. I thought the first film was warm. It was fuzzy. It was heartwarming. And I felt like the first film was a Christmas film anyway. So I was very confused why they even did a sequel, to be honest with you. But for me, there were some unexpectedly funny moments. There were some great cameos too. Shout out to the old woman who pops in every now and then and says, "You'll have to get through me."
over my dead body.
Dead body. Yeah, love it. That's almost as good as Mrs. Matheson.
Mrs. Matheson.
Those two actors will have to team together.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, I mean, I turned to Joe halfway through and I was like, wow, they're really trying hard, aren't they, to try and create some sort of drama or some sort of conflict in the film. Because it's just ridiculous how the animal welfare company have just got nothing better to do than just follow around James and his cat Bob all the time, trying to find ways to get rid of Bob. I mean, in a day and age where you've got COVID, you've got the recession, you know, people haven't got time to be chasing around Bob the cat, seeing what he's doing. So I just found it ridiculous. I was like, why do they care so much? It's like Line of Duty cat edition. They're all in their office going like, mom, with the cat still on the loose, we think he might be in trouble. And she's like, right, get your first team out there, SWAT team over to Bob now, because he's a danger to the welfare of this country. I mean, I was waiting for Bojo to do like a lockdown address, being like, right, stay inside, Bob is on the loose. We need to keep the children safe.
That's the film I want to see, actually.
Absolutely. I mean, they could have done so much with this, you know? But, you know, the biggest drama we have in this film is that Cat eats a gone-off chicken. I mean, what's going on there? God rest his soul. But yeah, so for me, it really paled in comparison. I find it quite disappointing. Some unintentional laughs. Joe and I were absolutely howling at times. And we were so glad that we were the only two people in the cinema. Yeah. Because if we weren't, oh, honestly, I think they would have called Animal Welfare to get us away out of the screen. I'll tell you what. I like this. You know, it was sweet, it's sentimental, it's a classic Christmas film. You know, it has a good message to it, doesn't it, about kind of forgiveness and coming together, and you're going to get that with any Christmas film. But for me, does not compare to the first film. I thought the first film was just far more charming, far more heartfelt, and also half the cast is missing as well. I felt like the cast in the first film were just so much better, and all the relationships that were established in the first film with James and his father, James and his neighbour, all those are completely gone, and it is definitely, you can definitely tell in this film that it's missing really badly. So yeah, not a great sequel for me, but if you want a couple of laughs, unintentionally, Oh, and a cameo from Jacqueline Wilson. Get yourself down there. So for me, not great. But what did you think, Joe?
Well, I knew we were in a good time when we that said cameo of Jacqueline Wilson appeared. It's about 5-10 minutes without spoiling anything. When he's at like a book event at the beginning of the film, and he's getting his
right.
Coat.
Can we do the scene right now? Can we have a go? So you can goes, be you can I be Jacqueline?
I'll be James. Jacqueline. I'll be James. Oh, I'll be James.
I'll be Jacqueline. Ready?
Okay. I'm putting my coat away, right? And then I turn to my right. I go, oh, hello, Jacqueline Wilson.
Oh, hi there, James. Oh, I can see by your face that you haven't quite finished the second book yet, have you?
No, you're absolutely right. You spotted that within 30 seconds that I've not written that book. But it's just so funny, so deadpan, that like it's like, you know, the Muppets, they get the likes of Steve Martin and, you know, like Billy Crystal and all these celebrity cameos. And a Christmas gift from Bob is happy and content with Jacqueline Wilson. And I think that's... I think that's lovely to a degree, but it did make me laugh. And we were expecting all sorts of authors to appear all the way through, but no.
I was expecting John Steinbeck to come back from the grave.
I don't know what is going
on. Maybe could have had a bit of that God off chicken.
I don't know what is going on anymore. But yeah, so I knew we were in for a good time when that happened, when Jacqueline Wilson appeared. I mean, I wasn't a fan of the first film. I thought it was tonally all over the place. It's like there's this cutesy cat comedy sort of film wrapped up in a drama about, you know, drug addiction and things like that. Didn't really work for me. I just thought it totally all over the place. And the same with here, really. It's supposed to be cutesy. It's supposed to be Christmas and things like that. And I know it's, you know, it's a true story. So it needs to have some sort of realism to it. But for me, it just got bogged down. It was like really depressing by the end of it. And it's like, on the one hand, you've got this really depressing story at the center of it. And then on the other hand, then you've got these really absurd, like comical characters, like the evil, like animal welfare guy. He's just like, literally, he looks like a cartoon. He looks like an evil cartoon character.
And it looks like he's come off a set of CBeebies, doesn't he, a little
yeah,
bit?
Yeah, exactly. Like, well, you know, it's the Lazy Town or whatever it's called. But yeah, you know, it's got the two things just don't mesh for me. They didn't in the first film. They don't this time around as well. And I just wish they would kind of pick one or the other, or at least do a better job of balancing the drama and the cuteness and the comedy. So yeah, the first one didn't work. This one didn't work for me either. I think the lead, what's his name, Luke Treadaway, I think he's just so dull in this. And he's a great actor. I've seen him in many stuff before. Like, he's fantastic in Attack the Block. But he's just really dull in this as well. He's just nothing to his character. And you said earlier on that they kind of tries to do the Christmas Carol thing of the, like 10 minutes in, it's like, oh, Christmas past. And Dan, you should have written the film, because to me, that would have been the obvious way to go down. That would have been the obvious route. But there's no real Christmas, you know, future, you know, the ghost of Christmas to come or anything like that. Why didn't they do that? They could have called it like a Bob Chris Pob's Christmas Carol, and it could have done that. And I think that would have been something more inventive. It would have been something a bit different, and maybe it would have given the story a bit more like excitement and a bit of like something to it.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and I feel like Bob could have come out as Ebenezer Scrooge at the end and be like, oh, you know,
be creative, you know, do like a glimpse to the future. And yeah, there's just so many creative ways they could have gone, but the way they went is a perfectly ordinary film, which we've seen time and time again. I can't say it'll be Macaulay Culkin and, you know, the Home Alone crew have anything to worry about anytime soon. I don't think Will Ferrell's shaking in his boots right now, thinking that, you know, it's going to overtake Elf. But yeah, it's perfectly normal. I think it will play well to a lot of people. I'm not the biggest cat person either, so like, you know, maybe that's it. Maybe if it was a dog, then maybe it'd be different. But as it stands, I thought it's perfectly ordinary and just really lackluster.
Oh, well, there we are. Well, if you want some good cheering up. Oh, stop you. Stop. Bob would not be happy. Right, well, yeah, Christmas Gift with Bob is in cinemas now, so go check it out if you're feeling festive. And that's all we've got time for on today's show. It's flown by. And don't forget you can tune in to all our old episodes on Mixcloud, Spotify, Apple Music, the whole thing. Make sure to check in on all our old episodes. And also, you can follow us on Facebook under the Dan and Joe Film Show. We're also on Twitter and Instagram at DJ Film Show. And I will put a lovely tribute to Bob the Cat on there. Rest in peace, Bob, for that. And as always, a big thank you to you, Joey, for another cracking show. I feel like we've laughed more this show than we ever had in any other show.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not sure how much of that will make it into the final show, but, you know, we have laughed a lot. And maybe it's because Christmas is around the corner. And if you are excited for Christmas, then be sure to tune in for our next show, because we're going to be talking about the Christmas Chronicles Part 2, which is going to be very exciting.
Absolutely. And Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell will be in the studio with us. Okay, we're going to make it happen.
People that.
No. We're trying. People. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and thank you again for listening, and we'll see you very soon for our next episode. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
So I just wanted to start off this review by saying, rest in peace, Bob the Cat. You are a true star, and we love you very much, and we wish you the best.
What the fuck?
I tried to do a nice one.
He's dead.
I don't know.
He's dead. Wish him the best.
In his grave, I don't know. Right, oh, I'll just leave that now. Anyway, I'll just go from there, and then we'll go from there. Ready? Okay. I just wanted to start... Oh, gosh. Oh, we'll just forget it. I'll do it at the end. Right, let's go from the top of the Bob's review.
Okay.